This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Elmer Bernstein, one of the great composers of Hollywood films, died Wednesday at his home in Ojai, California, at the age of 82. The more than 200 movies he scored ranged from classics like To Kill a Mockingbird to comedies like Animal House. Here's a sampling of his work. That was music from the films The Great Escape, The Sweet Smell of Success, The Ten Commandments, The Magnificent Seven, Far From Heaven, and The Man with the Golden Arm, all by composer Elmer Bernstein, who died Wednesday. Bernstein trained to be a concert pianist, but soon found that his love was writing for movies. His career was sidetracked for 5 years during the McCarthy era, but unlike many blacklisted artists, Bernstein actually considered himself a communist and spoke out on many leftist causes. He got back into major movies in 1955, when Otto Preminger hired him for The Man with the Golden Arm. Bernstein spent the next 4 decades composing in Hollywood, receiving 14 Academy Award nominations, but winning only once, for Thoroughly Modern Millie in 1967. Terry Gross spoke to Elmer Bernstein in 1991. They began by talking about his score for The Grifters, Stephen Frears' movie about con artists. Here's the opening theme.
The Grifters is a most unusual film, stylistically, and basically what it's about. I mean, we've all seen films about con men before, but this is a very, very special film with a very special atmosphere. Let me put it this way. I think the two critics who reviewed the film, one of them spoke of the score as wittily ironic, and another one said that it was playfully unsettling. I think that both of those critics caught what I was trying to do, which really answers the question.
And I think part of the way you get at that is the odd places that you'll hear percussion, like the odd rhythms that they play and the dissonances that you bring in.
Well, yes. First of all, the thematic material itself is very odd. Its closest relation would be the kind of things that they were doing in Europe, particularly Germany in the early 30s. It brings to mind perhaps something like Three Penny Opera. It is sort of faintly decadent and faintly off-center, which sort of sets the whole atmosphere for the film itself.
In a way, I think that The Grifters builds on some of your innovations from The Man with the Golden Arm, a movie that you scored in 1955, in the sense that it's a very urban music. It's a jazz-inspired music, and I think it really set a trend off. The movie starred Frank Sinatra as a jazz drummer and drug addict. So obviously it made sense to use a jazz score, but what else went behind the thinking of that?
Well, if we go back to The Man with the Golden Arm, it is precisely as you said. I mean, the atmosphere was Chicago. I mean, that's where it took place. Chicago is one of the great homes of early jazz. The main character in the film wanted to be a jazz drummer. And as a matter of fact, one of the crucial scenes in the film is when he goes to an audition as a drummer and tries to get himself a job. And that's where the idea of the jazz score grew. Jazz had been used before, more sparingly in scores. I think what made The Man with the Golden Arm seem special at the time was that the use of jazz was throughout the film, and a lot of the so-called scoring pieces, the dramatic background pieces, were also jazz-based. But the feeling for using jazz stemmed from the mise-en-scène and the main character.
Let me play some of the music you wrote for The Man with the Golden Arm, and then we'll talk more about the score.
Okay.
Music from The Man with the Golden Arm, composed by my guest Elmer Bernstein. This was at the very beginning of the period when jazz ended up being used a lot for detective movies and TV shows and hard-boiled movies and TV shows.
I'm not so sure. You know, it depends on what you mean. The Man with the Golden Arm was 1955. In 1957, you get Peter Gunn, which was Henry Mancini doing a score which was basically jazz-oriented. And then in 1958, a show called Staccato went on the air with John Cassavetes, also about a detective, for which I did the score, also jazz-oriented. So, I mean, I've had very mixed feelings about with The Man with the Golden Arm. Of course, I really cherish the memory of Man with the Golden Arm because it was actually the film that, so to speak, established my career. It did something else, which I have since regretted. Studio suddenly realizing how powerful the use of popular medium can be in a film score, because that hadn't been done in quite that way before. Not quite in the way I did in Man with the Golden Arm, not so thoroughly. And the effect of it, of course, was that the record album from the score was immensely successful. And it just sort of seemed to open up the floodgates, and from then on, score after score after score was using popular music of some kind, either jazz, and then finally it went to rock and roll scores, And unfortunately, a lot of this kind of music was used for its commercial value rather than its appropriateness to the dramatic action.
You were writing The Man with the Golden Arm. You were also writing the score for The Ten Commandments, which I think is one of the great movie religious epics. What kind of music to you seemed appropriate for a religious epic? You certainly want it to be big. And, of course, in Ten Commandments, you had to have music that was not only behind Moses, but behind God, you know? This is a tall order.
Yes, but we forgot something even more important.
What, Cecil B.
And
DeMille?
That's Cecil B. DeMille. We never forget Cecil B. DeMille. Actually, DeMille was very, I mean, I found that was probably the most interesting experience in my whole life in the movie business, working with Cecil B. DeMille on that film. The music for the film was basically, oh, how shall I say, the concept of the music was Wagnerian because that's what DeMille wanted. When I say Wagnerian, DeMille's concept of the way music should work in a film was that each character should have a theme. And when the character is on the screen, that is what you use, their theme every single time. If there are two characters on the screen, then you would then find some clever way of incorporating both of the themes. In that sense, it's very, well, that's what I mean by a Wagnerian concept.
Do you feel that eventually the religious epics ended up with a set of musical cliches?
Well, I could answer that in one word, yes. well, necessarily so. I mean, you know, it's very interesting about that. When we finished the Ten Commandments, the music of the Ten Commandments, and I'd gotten to the point at that time when I could address Mr. DeMille without saying, Mr. DeMille, sir, and all that sort of thing. And I said to him, wouldn't you like to remake the picture about Christ? He'd made a picture about Christ, Sign of the Cross, at the same, sort of in the same period when he made the first Ten Commandments. And DeMille said to me, he was a very sort of knowledgeable person about the world and the body politic, so to speak. And DeMille said, you know, I don't think you can make that kind of picture anymore in the atmosphere which exists in the world today. Because, you see, I think one of the problems is that that kind of picture is much easier to deal with in terms of the sensibilities and sensitivities of the public by sticking with the cliches, because which have grown up in the last 100 years, like what we consider churchy music, for instance. Because I think if you don't do that, you then run the risk of somebody feeling that you're being sacrilegious. And DeMille sensed this, you know, that it would be very difficult to make that kind of a picture in this day and age. And I think indeed it is.
Let's listen to some of the music you wrote for the Exodus scene for the Ten Commandments. And
I can tell you a funny story about that after you listen to it.
Oh, swell. Okay. And I want to point out something obvious here, which is that it's the beginning starts off as if a shofar is blowing, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. That's pretty obvious. Here we go. This is
that's a funny story, too.
Okay. Well, we'll hear the stories after we hear the music. Okay. Music from the Exodus scene of the Ten Commandments, composed by my guest, Elmer Bernstein. Music from the Ten Commandments, composed by my guest, Elmer Bernstein. Okay, the funny stories.
Well, the first place, you know, when we realized that a shofar was going to be seen on the screen, we had to find somebody to play the shofar. Now, for those who don't know, the shofar is a very ancient instrument made out of a ram's horn. And it sounds very much like not very much, but something like a French horn, a brassy kind of sound. Anyway, where do you find people who play the shofar? Well, who plays shofars? Of course, rabbis, because it's still used in Jewish ceremonies. Well, one day, DeMille got, we must have had, 20 or 30 rabbis on the on the scoring stage. And because we wanted to get different kinds of perspectives on the sound, we had them all over the scoring stage playing these shofars. But the funny part was it was on a Friday, and we were getting dangerously close to twilight time, and we had to stop suddenly because, of course, all the rabbis have to stop working by sundown on Friday. So that was the shofar story. The story about the whole Exodus music is originally, I mean, in the Exodus, there were about 8,000 people in that scene. I don't know how many animals, but it was about 8,000 people. And they move quite slowly, necessarily, as 8,000 people would, carrying their belongings with them. So I wrote a sort of very slow, anthem-like processional. DeMille heard it, he hated it. And I said, well, what was wrong with that? I mean, it looks like the picture to me. He says, that's the trouble. It looks like the picture. And the picture is too slow. He said, now I have to tell you that these 8,000 Hebrews in this scene were being played by 8,000 members of the Egyptian army, which is already pretty funny. And DeMille said, no, I want something with spirit. He said, something like Onward Christian Soldiers. And so finally we have that is... accounts for the way the Exodus sounds now, but it always seemed funny to me because it was terrifically ecumenical, because eventually what you have is 8,000 Egyptians playing Hebrews marching off to music like Onward Christian Soldiers.
That's terrific. Let's get to another score that you wrote. This is such a great theme. I'm thinking of the theme from The Magnificent Seven, which was a Western epic based loosely on the Seven Samurai. Now, you wrote the theme for this. It was also a big pop hit. It was in the top 40, a version conducted by Al Caiola. And
yes, Al Caiola did a sort of guitar arrangement of it.
Yeah, was that good for you? Did you wish you had the hit?
No, I'm basically very unselfish that way. I'm funny about that. I don't like to see the attitudes of the music changed, and in that sense, the Al Caiola thing was very, very different. That bothered me a little bit. No, it didn't bother me that he had a hit, because, I mean, obviously it was very good for me. The best thing that ever happened from a purely economic point of view, that happened with the Magnificent Seven, is the theme was leased by a certain tobacco company.
We could say the name. People remember the Marlboro commercials
with this music. And that's terribly funny. When I perform this piece at concerts, especially in Europe where they still use those commercials, where they can still do those kinds of cigarette commercials, I can hear the whisper go through the audience. They hear it, and of course they know it better as the Marlboro thing.
Well, Elmer Bernstein, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your music.
Thank you.
Composer Elmer Bernstein speaking with Terry Gross in 1991. Bernstein died Wednesday at his home in Ojai, California at the age of 82.